All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Boy, that gets you going. Gets me going. All right, that's Let There Be Drums from Sandy Nelson. And again, really glad to be back and talking with you today. And we have a very special show today, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Peter Gleick, author and head of the Pacific Institute. And we're going to be talking about his book, Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water, A Tale of the Destruction of Lives, Health, and the Planet. So you want to stick around for that one. And opening the show up,
I'm very pleased to be doing this part of the show. It's something I've really wanted to talk with you about. I've made the announcement about this a number of times over the last few weeks. And this is about the fact that on November 15th, there's going to be a historic dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person, in Riverside Church in New York. And the dialogue is Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. Joining us today will be some three members of the host committee for this dialogue. And they are Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Stop Mass Incarceration Network, David Zeiger, the filmmaker whose films include Sir, No, Sir, and the TV series Senior Year, which just had its 15th anniversary, I think, and Saskia Sassen, who's the Robert S. Lind Professor of Sociology and co-chair of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University. We're going to be talking with the three of these folks, but before we do, I have a very special announcement, an invitation from Cornel West to the dialogue between him and Bob Avakian at Riverside Church in New York City. All right, so I want you to hear that, and then we'll be right back.
I want to encourage you to come to this rich dialogue between myself and my very dear brother, Bob Avakian. You're going to have a revolutionary Christian. You're going to have a revolutionary communist. We're going to be wrestling with the issues of religion and revolution. You're going to hear agreement and disagreement. You're going to hear transgression and convergence. But most importantly, you're going to hear two brothers who are for real focusing on those friends for known called the wretched of the earth. How we can resist, how we can be resilient, how we can move toward fundamental social change.
All right, welcome back. That was Cornel West with a special invitation to this dialogue, all right? I'm pleased to welcome my guest today. We'll be talking with all three guests, but I want to bring Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network on the air first. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. It's good to talk to you, man, especially about this, because I've been waiting to talk to people about this for quite some time, all right? And getting the word out big and broad around all over the country about this. So, Carl, tell people what this dialogue is.
What this dialogue is it's going to be a high-level, substantive interaction between two dynamic leaders over a very timely and very big question in society for hundreds of millions of people around the world. I mean, just starting with that question of who these people are, and I know both of these brothers. I've had deep conversation with both Cornel West and Bob Avakian. I've worked with them around building resistance and how to bring to people an understanding of what the problems are, and I know how deeply they get into things and the intellectual integrity and mutual respect they bring to conversation. So to see these two people coming from different perspectives, as Cornel said, a revolutionary communist in Bob Avakian, a revolutionary Christian in Cornel, but dialoguing and getting into some of the things that they agree about and exploring areas of disagreement, I am eagerly anticipating this because let me tell you, it's going to be electrifying.
Well, when you talk about that you know both of these people and you've had a deep discussion and intimate discussion with them, you know, tell me a little bit about the impact that these two, because these two people also, as I understand it, have had a big impact on your life.
Let me just start with Bob Avakian. I mean, and I go back 40 years ago, I think it was, that I had my first in-depth discussion with him. And I came into this discussion sharply disagreeing with him. There were sharp questions up in the revolutionary movement over what was the road forward. And he was arguing for one road and I was arguing for another. And we had a chance encounter. We began to discuss, starting out from a position of arguing. But then as we got a couple hours into it, I began to realize, like, we're both revolutionaries. We're trying to get rid of these horrors and bring into being a world without exploitation and oppression, but he's coming at it different than I am. He's coming at it from that future world we're trying to bring into being, and then trying to figure out from here how we get there. And I was more stuck in the contradictions, divisions, and other things about today. And we ended up not getting any sleep that night because we spent the whole night discussing. And I came out of that with a changed perspective. And that's a role that Avakian has played, you know, throughout my adult life as a revolutionary. And I really want people to be there to hear what this revolutionary leader has got to say, because he's the architect of a whole new framework for the emancipation of humanity. And I want people to experience what's been the inspiration and the guidance for all the work that I've been doing over these decades. I want people to have a chance to experience that. So I really want them to be there. You know, and with Cornell, I only go back about two decades, but that's a pretty good time. And I've dialogued with him, shared public stages. I've shared jail cells with him. We've initiated important work to take on stop and frisk, to take on mass incarceration. And this is a brother who's as at home getting into jazz and rhythm and blues as he is talking about philosophy or world history. And he goes at everything very deeply, but he has the same, this is something that he really shares with Avakian, they have an approach of mutual respect with people they're talking with. You know, you can be disagreeing with them, arguing with them, but they're actually listening to what you have to say, evaluating it, and responding to it in its best light, not looking for, oh, there's a weakness I can pull to get the leg up on this person, but no, let's get into this. I think this person is wrong on this. Let me try to show them why they're wrong, but also let me learn from what they're saying and seeing whether there's some things that are correct that I need to incorporate into my approach to stuff. That's why I think this is going to be both electrifying and refreshing, mm-hmm. because you don't often see that kind of exchange. You more see disagreements that bring out heat rather than light, that don't enlighten people about what the issues are and how to look at them, but more somebody trying to up one another or down the other person. This is going to be totally different than that, and I think people will really be delighted, moved, and challenged by it.
Carl, just one real quick question, and then we're going to bring in our other guests. But okay. What would you say, very quickly, is if you can, what would you say, I mean, listening to it, I'm very inspired about it, but I'm also going to ask you this. What would you say if you had to tell somebody, what's the heart of this dialogue?
I guess I think the heart of this dialogue has to do with getting people to think deeply, to critically assess things, and to reflect on what kind of people we need to be and what kind of world we want to live in and what needs to be done and what can be done to bring that world into being. And I think the two speakers are going to come at it differently, but they both are very strong on this question of morality and people approaching things from that perspective and getting at, can we be the kind of people who view horrors and stand aside hoping they don't hit us, or that we have to stand up and deal with those horrors. And then people can dig into different approaches to how to do that, because that's going to be presented in a very deep and thoroughgoing way with a lot of intellectual integrity and mutual respect.
All right, Carl, I want to let people know, too, that they're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dixon, a Revolutionary Communist Party, David Zeiger, filmmaker, and Saskia Sassen. Who's the Robert S. Lind Professor of Sociology and co-chair of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia. And I want to move into talking with my other guests. As part of that, I want to actually make the point, too, that, you know, people should know there was a host committee that came together around this event, and it brought together a remarkable group of people. They've issued statements and supporting the dialogue, including people who, like Alice Walker and Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. And then there's an actual host committee that contains a broad array of people, and it's really interesting. Ed Asner, William Ayers, Richard Brown, former Panther and the San Francisco 8 defendant, Reverend Dr. Mary Kara, Peter Coyote, Annie Day, Emery Douglas, Carol Downer, Carl Hart, Aubrey Hendricks, religious people involved, Raymond Latta, Reverend Cecil Murray is part of the host committee, Arturo Farrell, pianist, Matthew Shipp, who we've had on the show, musician and composer. It goes on and on and on, including people like who's had their loved ones killed by the police, people like Juanita Young and Nicholas Hayward, whose children were killed by the New York City Police Department, and Robert Young, a filmmaker, as well as my next two guests, David Zeiger and Saskia Sassen. Saskia, I want to talk to you first.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm very fine. Thank you.
Good, good, good. Well, let's jump into this. What is it? You know, we've listened to what Carl was saying about this dialogue. What made you?
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah.
I loved what Carl was saying. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. What made you want to be part of this?
Well, I mean, I have known Raymond Latta for a long time. I've known, you know, I've spent many years in Chicago where, you know, there were quite a few people there who were interested in what Bob Avakian had to say. And I've known Cornel West. Cornel West and I have been in these strange settings, say in North Africa, where you had religious people from many, many different religions. And so what I like really about this dialogue is that it is not the typical dialogue. It is not the typical people. And it is not this very domesticated, careful mode of talking about where we are at and what we need. I think what both Cornel West and Bob Avakian are about is opening up new ground. We are in a disastrous situation. Our state, our liberal state, is in severe decay. Not just ours, by the way, all around. So I think we really need to focus on, in a way, on the extreme conditions that are often left out. We're always focusing on the middle, the median, the mean. We really need to focus at the edges, the horrors that are happening. And so I think that a more radical way of looking at where we're at, where there are no easy remedies, that sort of draws me. And these, each of them has a very strong category that organizes their thinking and their passions. And that is also very good. That's good theater even. You know, religion and revolution. I mean, can you ask for more?
Nope, that's good for me. Here's a question for you, though. When you said not typical on all these different levels, can you talk about that a little bit more, what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I just finished a book. This is not about my book now that I want to talk, but I want to say that in my book, I make an argument that we are always staying away from examining what all is getting expelled from our system, whether that is people who disappear in prisons forever or in displaced people's camps in the global south, whether that is all the long-term unemployed who are no longer counted. And so we say, oh, we have employment growth. Well, that's nice. But what would happen if we actually included all of those people who have been expelled from the system? We're seeing whole cities like Detroit expelled. So I think that we have reached a point where these processes that have been going on for quite a while have attained extreme conditions. The way we measure, the way we describe, we leave the extreme condition out. And I think we need to begin to focus on these extreme conditions. And so I think that both Cornel and Avakian are very radical thinkers. There are a lot of great thinkers and very nice thinkers. There are very few really radical ones. Now, I grew up in Latin America. You know, in Latin America, we're far more comfortable on some level with radicalisms of various sorts. So to me, this seems like a necessary type of conversation, and I'm surprised that it didn't happen much sooner in a way. Did I answer your question? Or
yes,
did I
yes,
just
yes,
take
yes,
off
yes.
in my own?
No, it was a great answer. It was a great answer. And in fact, it led me to this because it was one of the questions I was going to ask you is that having looked at some of what you've done in your life and the idea that your work, a lot of it gets focused up exactly around what you're saying, globalization, various forms of it, and the impact it has in the world. And that has a definite relationship between, it seems there's a definite relationship as you're talking between that and you deciding that you had to be part of this event. Is that true?
Well, absolutely. To me, this is a natural. Also, Raymond Latta is very persuasive, you know. Because now we know that this is going to be a great event. When he started, maybe that there was also work to be done there. But I absolutely thought this was perfect. And I'm very glad that there are two other colleagues of mine at Columbia University. One is a professor of philosophy who are in the host committee. Even though, you know, it's not a Columbia University event, but it's great to have since it's in the neighborhood, so to say. That we have this mix of people, you know, artists, militant, you know, workers and profs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We the professors. I love that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Let me bring Dave Zeiger on and see what he has to say about all this. David, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Michael. I feel a little. I feel very humbled in the wake of both of your other guests. I feel kind of like there's a Peanuts cartoon where Linus and Charlie Brown are looking up the clouds, and Linus just says Charlie Brown says, "What do you see?" And Linus describes this in depth. Deep, Michelangelo painting that he sees, and then Charlie Brown says, "I see a ducky and a horsey."
We need that.
Yeah, well, that's what I feel like.
Well, let's talk about this. What is it about this event that grabbed you?
Well, several things. You mentioned how that we're in disastrous times, and I feel that very, very deeply. And what's disastrous about it is not only what exists in the world, but also what doesn't exist in the world. And that's the thing that I'm constantly looking for and trying to find ways to connect with, which is exactly what you said. You know, not only a radical, but really a genuinely revolutionary future that, you know, I myself have tremendous skepticism about the possibility of it just because of how disastrous the world is. But I know that there are very few people right now who are actually pointing in that direction and struggling to find the direction. And I know that Bob Avakian, the work that he's done, ultimately it's the only thing that can overcome kind of the despair about the possibilities, because in order to get rid of this system, it has to be, a future, a different system. And I know that, I come out of the 60s, and I know that with the dramatic change, the coup in China and Mao's death, and since then, everything about what happened in the 60s in China and in revolution has been kind of pulverized in the media and in the public consciousness. The one person who's really been struggling to learn the lessons from that and not lose the experiment that was very much a part of, or, you know, a beginning of, is Bob Avakian. And then on the other hand, Cornel West is, you know, from his perspective is equally, you know, intolerant of anything that keeps this system going and keeps the way that, you know, the manifestations of it happening. And so I do think this is this is going to be a tremendous thing, that this dialogue is happening, and that it's, you know, that it can, you know, move on in other things. You know, as a filmmaker, I've made one film about the 60s, the Sir No Sir, about the GI movement, and now I'm struggling to develop a film about the student movement. And I was talking to someone recently from Boston University, and she said the very first thing we did, in 1964, was a teach-in that went all night on the campus, and, you know, that thousands of students were there, and there were speakers from all over, and they stayed up all night, you know, struggling and debating and arguing. That kind of thing doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the kind of atmosphere, you know, about both, you know, strategy and also the big questions that everyone has. And this is something that I think is part of that tradition, and that's what's needed right now.
You know, as you wrote in your statement as part of the host committee, you wrote something that really grabbed me, actually. You were posing a question to people broadly. You were saying, look, you know, if you want fundamental change, you're really going to have to look at fundamental questions, and that has everything to do with this dialogue. That was an extremely important point to be making, I think.
Yeah, everyone's heads, including, you know, thousands of very progressive and even radical people, their heads get drawn down into who should be the next president, or, you know, how do we convince Obama to do something different than what he's doing? And, I mean, it just becomes this stranglehold. I won't name names, but it's someone who's very close to me who's been all very big on Obama and all of that. Her thing now is, I can't wait till he's not president anymore, because then he'll be able to do what he really wants to do. You know, and
yeah.
I mean, you're just in the mud there, and it's the fundamental questions that actually change things. You know, it's those big questions about how the world is and what philosophy is about that actually, you know, makes it possible to get out of that kind of.
I also think, you know, when you look at history, which is something that I really like to do, no formal system of power has lasted forever. So we tend to think that what else is there, you know, where we're at now? I mean, it's almost unimaginable. But we've got to get out of the system we're in now. Now, I am for markets, but the Adam Smith market, which is a people's market, you know, like the market square in the small town, not for this extraordinary so-called market system that you have in finance. That's not market. That's deployment of power, absorption of all resources. It is an extremely abusive. I don't know if anybody picked up on this fact that many of us already knew because of Freedom of Information Act, but that the Fed secretly transferred over $10 trillion to the global banking system. That was our money. While they were debating TARP in Congress, the Fed was just taking, you know, far, far much more out directly to redistribute among the banks. Of course, now they cannot afford, you know, housing for the poor and all of that. I mean, this is truly a decaying system. No matter who the president is, you know, it doesn't matter, really, I think. Mm-hmm. So something has to change. And I don't know what the form. I wouldn't want a militarized change, of course, but something really has to change radically, because we're on self-destruct mode. It's going to hit more and more people eventually.
Okay.
We can see that in the impoverishment of the middle classes. You know, these middle classes that thought they had it made, more or less, and now their sons and daughters are poorer than they are, etc. So this is an indication that this is truly a process of decay, of losses.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with three members of the host committee for an upcoming dialogue in New York City at Riverside Church on November 15th. And the dialogue is between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, and it's titled Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. And actually, our guests are, it's Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, David Zeiger, filmmaker, and Saskia Sassen, the Robert S. Lynn Professor of Sociology and the co-chair of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University. And they're all members of the host committee for this event. Now, Carl, let me ask you this. One of the things that I've seen, and when I've talked to people, I've been going out broadly with this, and when I've talked to people, that the topic of it, revolution and religion, that is something, yeah, that a lot of people zero in on, you know, and they comment that that's something they really feel a need to dig into, that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why this topic as opposed to any other?
I think that this topic is, one, it's very timely, and it is something that is literally a matter of great concern for hundreds of millions, if not billions of people around the world, you know, because a lot of people go at it in terms of, well, how can humanity be good without God? You know, we need an external force to set moral standards, or otherwise there would just be chaos and all this kind of stuff. And then you have people grappling with, well, can religion be a motivator to take on social injustice? And then other people who say, well, it's really a fetter. So there's really a lot of questioning and grappling with this. And then the other thing that I think is very important about it is the approach of both of these speakers, because, like I said before, morality is going to be a big part of what they get into, but it really does come down to what kind of people are we going to be and what kind of world we want to live in and the relationship between that in terms of the role of people in acting to bring that world into being. And I think another reason that that's timely, however you look at religion, there are a lot of people who are now beginning to wonder and some beginning to act on doing something about these horrors, who need to lift their sights and to look more at, well, what can be done to get out from under this stuff? Not how do we, you know, make some changes within an overall setup that is itself the problem. But is there another framework within which humanity could live? Is there another kind of world that could really be brought into being? And what would need to be done to do that? And that's something that I think people will get a very rich exchange on, because Avakian, of course, comes from a whole new framework of what that world could be like, how to bring it into being, the process for that, the strategic approach. And the Cornell has a burning desire to see people not become, as he puts it, adapted to indifference or adjusted to injustice. And that, and the love for humanity, and especially for, as he puts it, the least of these, motivates him in everything he goes. So I think this topic with these two speakers is really going to be something that is illuminating for a lot of people and will lead people to think more deeply about this and to think about their own role in relation to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that point about this is a topic that is really a burning question for hundreds of millions, billions of people around the world. You know, you think about this and what they're confronting. And one of the things I was really excited about was, you know, a lot of times when a dialogue like this happens, there's a certain audience that is drawn in, which is an important audience. But in this one in particular, there seems to be as well a broader outreach to people, including a lot of people who are never really invited into these things or don't feel welcome into these things. That's the people that live on the bottom of society. Go ahead, Saskia.
I just wanted to add something on the religion question.
Sure.
So I teach this very, very large, almost 300 students who I hope will all go undergrad. This is my undergrad lecture class at Columbia. And, you know, for these young, very smart students, which come from all fields, physics, history, you name it, you know, both of these terms, religion and a revolution, are variables. On the one hand, some good things. In the middle, it's wobbly. And at the other extreme, it's really bad. So for them, it's actually a questioning. What are we talking about when we say religion? It's not necessarily a positive. And the same thing with revolution. Because they think of ISIS, well, that's a revolutionary movement. They don't like it, right? So for them, these young minds who are very inquisitive minds, they're very smart, for them it is also an opportunity to think along with two sharp speakers about the meanings. These are very, very both complex but also very ambiguous terms, concepts for these young students. So I think that that's an added value, and that is also how I am sort of trying to persuade them, you know, to come to this event.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, right before we will move on to Dave in a minute, but right before that, I did want to hear a little bit about your thinking on this really important effort to reach out to people who aren't normally brought into this.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we really want to do on this, because I made a point about the high level at which both of these speakers go into things, but also the way in which they're motivated by concern for those on the bottom and work to reach out to those on the bottom, you know, because they want to bring this to people who catch the hardest hell in this society. They want to bring them in, and we're doing efforts, you know, like we're working on transportation to bring people from different parts of the East Coast and the Midwest.
Oh, that's great.
New York City for this. But we're also working on a bus to go from Harlem over to Riverside, which is not that great a distance, but there's a big gap between Riverside Church and the people in the projects in Harlem. And we want to bring people together to cross that gap together, make people feel welcome and that this is for them. And then even some of the statements about the dialogue, the letter from the ex-prisoner talking about why he's excited about this dialogue and why he wants to be a part of it. We're really trying to work to bring people who are usually left out of intellectual discourse and even told that they don't have the wherewithal and the capability to be a part of it, to bring them in and let them be involved and let them also experience this discussion over new frameworks, new ways the world could be, and what kind of people we need to be to help bring that into being.
Mm-hmm. David, what's your take on this whole point about the centrality, this question of religion, revolution, its meaning in the world? What, you know, what's your take on that?
Well, it's both. Well, certainly, I mean, the religion has become, in the last 10, 15 years, such a massive point, a massive, you know, kind of a lightning rod on every level. And but what's missing, even on religion, what's missing is the you know, in any kind of visible way, is the kind of religion that Cornel West represents. You know, I'm an atheist myself.
Me too.
You know, I connect a good, I connect a lot with the Carl. You too. I can connect a lot with the sentiment and the concept of, you know, spirituality that, that Cornel West represents, and out there in the world, there's almost anything but. And so, it's a obviously a complicated issue, but it's the one thing is something that everyone, you know, wrangles with in their own mind and in their community and in their and in their life. I mean, it's putting it on the level that this debate is putting it on is, you know, like you said earlier, it's quite a revelatory thing, because that's not how people think about either religion or revolution at this point. But it's also connecting with something that people are dealing with all every day in their lives.
Let me just say this. We have about maybe 6 minutes left, and I want to basically get to this question, all right? And it's something that I think for all three of you. And Saskia, maybe you first. I was reading the statement from one of the host committee members that really it sort of made me think a lot, and it was from Carol Downer, who's an attorney here in Los Angeles, and she's also the founder of the Feminist Women's Health Center. And she made a point that she was, you know, she talked about how the kind of discourse that goes on in society today is not only not appealing, it's just, you know, hard for people to take. Okay. So consequently, not a lot of it is paid attention to or taken. People don't take part in it. But she said about this, that one of the things she was looking forward to was that there would be, it was around setting new standards in a sense of fundamental questions with principled discourse around them. And I wanted to ask you, what do you hope to, that that is achieved by this dialogue?
Well, I think Carol Downer really nailed it down. I think that is a very, very good way of putting it, that we really lack. We lack language. We lack imagery of what our alternatives. It's much easier today to just be a critic like I am. You know, you can demolish one thing after the other and show how bad they are or how whatever, but how without promise. But to actually construct an alternative sort of set of images and points, you know, short phrases that capture. Cornel is a master at this. I've been enough times with him to see that he's very, very good. You know, just give, I mean, language, especially if it's short sentences or images, visual images also, that those are tools, those are instruments that have their own impact. They make you think differently. They make you see stuff that you hadn't thought about. And from where I look at things now, I'm my passion is documenting all the things that we don't see. Either statistically we don't see them with our eyes, even if we're standing in front of them, we don't see a lot of stuff. So to me this, and then I add to that again what I said about my students, for whom both of these terms are very wobbly. They don't know what to do with it. They're really interested, however, as I think Dave said, to know that these are foundational elements in our lives. So I sort of see this mix of providing images and language to people who know that things are really wrong, but who cannot know how to sort of talk about it almost. And the other one is some clarifications on the question of religion. Again, what was said about Cornell, it's really a kind of spirituality. This is not religion as dogma. This is another dimension that is part of all, that is part of our humanity. It goes beyond believing or not in some God, right? So I think that this is really a very powerful and promising combination, these two.
And I think, you know, it's really true, this point about that's been made a couple places in some of the writings about this dialogue, about this is actually touching on a question, the deepest questions of what it means to be human, and modeling a different approach. And let me, Dave, do you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I see a ducky and a horsey. not really.
All right. Carl, what about you?
I guess what I would say is two things. One is I think that people who come to this dialogue will experience an approach to getting into deep and very fundamental questions about the way the world is. And does it need to be that way? And that people will come off of this really reflecting deeply on, again, like I said earlier, what kind of people we want to be and what kind of world we want to live in and our role in realizing that world. But also, this goes back to something that Dave raised about what's missing in the political scene today, this question of there is a different way. and there really is a way to bring that into being in terms of revolution and a strategic approach to that, being more out there on the scene. And I think that's something that's also going to happen off of this dialogue, both with the people who are in the house to experience it, also at the simulcast in Los Angeles. But then in other ways, the fact that this is happening and people are hearing that it's happening, and then they're going to want to, well, is there any...
Yeah, I agree. I agree with all of that. Right, right. Yeah.
So that's it. That's
okay.
What I think.
All right. Did you have more you wanted to add, Saskia?
No, I'm fine. I said,
okay.
I didn't say it all, but I said enough.
Okay. All right. I want to thank all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for having us on.
That's great.
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. And you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with three members of the host committee for the upcoming dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And it's called Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. And it's Cornel West and Bob Avakian live and in person November 15th, 2014 at 3 to 7 p.m. in Riverside Church in New York City. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Peter H. Gleick, author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss this one. Welcome back. That was Blues All Night from Charlie Musselwhite, and I thought that was an extremely appropriate song for our next segment and our next guest. Peter H. Gleick is the president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Award, and he's the author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water, and he's a fervent, ardent drinker of tap water. Okay, so wrap your head around that one. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me
sure.
on.
Sure. I got to tell you, I was reading your book. I was horrified, surprised, and extremely pleased to read some of the things that you were revealing in this book. This is really a book well worth reading for anybody who's concerned about the state of humanity and the state of the planet, but also just the hucksterism and what's really getting a scientific view of all of these things that were so often presented as you're walking through society and your head's spinning because you have no idea what the hell's going on. You know, tap water, bottled water, what do I do here? But let me begin with this, a quote from the beginning of your book. You say, every second of every day in the United States, 1,000 people buy and open up a plastic bottle of commercially produced water. And every second of every day in the United States, 1,000 plastic bottles are thrown away. 85 million bottles a day. More than 30 billion bottles a year at a cost to consumers of tens of billions of dollars. And for every bottle consumed in the U.S., another 4 are consumed around the world. Peter, what the hell is going on here?
Well, that's a great question. It's a big story, this bottled water thing. It sort of has come out of nowhere over the last decade or so. As sort of unbeknownst to us, sales have grown and grown and grown until all of a sudden bottled water's everywhere. I think it's time that we ask, what's really going on? And as I talk about in the book, I think there are 4 things going on. I think we're increasingly afraid of our tap water. We have a wonderful tap water system in the United States, although, as I point out in the book, it's not as good as it could be and not as good as it should be. But it's a great system that most of the rest of the world wishes they had. So we're afraid of our tap. I think we're deluged and bombarded with misleading advertising about bottled water, about how it's going to make us healthier or sexier or skinnier or more stylish if we drink this or that brand of bottled water. And I think it's harder and harder to find public water. The water fountains are disappearing at the same time that bottled water is everywhere. You can buy it. Most of us could probably think right now a place to buy bottled water that's a couple of blocks from where we're sitting or even closer.
Yeah, I could walk out the door here and just reach the refrigerator and find a zillion bottles of bottled water. I mean, think about it. For people my age, your age, and I was asking people in the station this morning, when we were kids, when we were younger, bottled water was really a rarity. I mean, we used to drink out of a hose.
It was unheard of. I grew up in New York City originally, a city that has a wonderful public water supply. If my mother had ever come home with bottled water from the store, it would have been a stunning event. It was just unheard of. We all drank from the fountains, from the taps, from water, from fire hydrants in the street. That's just the way it was, and I think that's the way it still should be.
Well, you know, when you were talking about the causes of all this or how this happened, one of the things I think, it's not just that we fear the tap, because I think actually from my perspective, there's actually a healthy suspicion of what's going on, what the government is doing to people, and things that we find out many years later that, oh, yeah, we meant to tell you about that mosquito truck you used to run behind, DDT, and it'll kill you. So there's all these things that come out, and we actually, there's fear of the tap, there's suspicion of the government, but there was actually a war on tap water that was orchestrated by the bottled water czars.
Well, that's right. I think their biggest competitor is the tap. If they can make us fear the tap, which isn't that hard, they can convince us to buy a bottled water, their commercial private product, at 1,000 times or more what we pay for our tap water. Now, you know, I argue that our tap water should be better, but I also think there's a lot of fear of the tap that's unwarranted. I think the tap water we get is, for the most part in this country, remarkably safe. Incredibly safe. I think it could be safer. I think there are things that are in it that aren't well regulated or that we don't fully understand sometimes the consequences of some of the things that are in our tap water. But we know how to produce tap water of any quality. We could produce the best quality tap water with technology that we have at a cost far below what we spend for bottled water. And so fix the tap system, ensure that people trust it, make it so that people can trust it again. And that will help drive the sales of bottled water, which has all sorts of problems associated with it, back down to what it ought to be, which is an occasional luxury product.
Well, you also make the point, and we'll talk about this, we can talk about it now, or we can talk about it a little bit later, is that while you're exposing all this, that bottled water in and of itself is actually not the root cause of the problem we're facing in relation to water. I mean, I've lived in many parts of the third world, and frankly, bottled water is absolutely essential and has been, unfortunately, one of the ways that I think one of the things that has cut down on things like cholera and these other waterborne diseases that kill quite a few people. And it's not enough, obviously, and there's actually more needs to be done to get access to healthy, clean water, water that would be the equivalent of the tap system in this country. I was in KwaZulu in South Africa, and I once made the mistake, temporary insanity. I was really thirsty, and I was in this little sort of rondeval that was, just had a sink in there. It had a tap. And for whatever reason, I walked over, got a big glass. The water was cold, poured it down, and my friends who were from KwaZulu looked at me and said, "Whoa, we don't even do that." And boy, I was sick for a long time. But
well,
that's – go ahead.
You know, without a doubt, there are parts of the world where you can't drink the tap water, and that certainly has spurred the bottled water industry overseas. But again, the answer is that's unfair. That's inequitable. That's not the world we want to live in. We want a world where governments build and maintain and operate a high-quality, inexpensive tap water system for everyone. If we don't do that, what happens is the rich buy bottled water and the sick continue to drink contaminated water and they get sick and they die. The poor get sick and they die. And that's not the world we want. And that's the world we got rid of in the United States 100 years ago when we built a high-quality tap water system. We got rid of cholera and dysentery and typhoid, those same water-related diseases, when we started filtering and chlorinating our tap water. I think the bottled water industry is a symptom of a big problem. I think you're exactly right. It's not a problem. Well, it is a problem by itself, mm-hmm. which we can get into. But it's because of these other reasons that we feel compelled to believe that bottled water must be better. Now, I'd also point out, there's no guarantee that the quality of bottled water is any better than our tap water. It's not as well regulated as our tap water. And so sometimes people buy bottled water because they think it's better than tap water, but I think often we're fooling ourselves.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You know, when I first came out here, I was shocked at how much bottled water was a part of people's lives. I was living on the East Coast, and at that point, bottled water wasn't just that big a part of my life. But when I came out here, I mean, people I was staying with were insistent they were going, and it always used to freak me out because they would go to Vons and they would buy, you know, they would see a machine selling water, and it was just a water dispenser, you know, and they would put their dollar in or their quarter, whatever, and get gallon after gallon of water that later was exposed as a total sham. It was just tap water that had been put in the machine. But people really believed that they were drinking safer water. What's the truth here?
Well, our tap water is regulated by the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Bottled water is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration as a food product because it's in this little packaged container. And that's why, in fact, that incredibly uninformative nutrition label is what's on it, which tells us really nothing. The regulations are supposed to be similar and, for the most part, are fairly similar. But bottled water is not as strictly regulated in many cases, I believe, as tap water. The monitoring of bottled water is done by the companies themselves, not by independent agencies. The reporting isn't as good as for tap water, and there's some big loopholes. I think for the most part, bottled water is perfectly safe. I think for the most part, tap water is perfectly safe. But consumers should not assume that bottled water is any better or any safer or any better regulated than tap water. I think that's a false assumption.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking right now with Peter Gleick, the author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. Now, Peter, one of the things that shocked me in the book to see, I mean, you talked about the lax regulation, lax to zero regulation, or even if the rules are written, they're rarely enforced. And what that leaves the door open to, I mean, you know, E. coli, a lot of us are used to, you know, oh God, E. coli, it's in the hamburger or it's in the, you're on your lettuce leaves or your spinach or whatever. So you're, you know, scrubbing your spinach with an iron brush. But actually, there's instances, or it's possible that E. coli and other coliform bacteria is actually in the bottled water because they don't check for it, right?
Well, they do. They're supposed to check for it. But the rules, again, especially for things like that kind of bacteria, like E. coli, are stricter for tap water. They have to monitor daily, often dozens of times a day in a big city, for bacteria like that, for E. coli. And if they find any, they have to notify the public right away. And they have to issue alerts so that people don't drink it. Now, it's very rare in tap water. But for bottled water, they have to look every now and then, not as often, for the most part, as big cities do. And, in fact, they're allowed to have some bacteria, small amounts of bacteria in bottled water, without it being considered contaminated. When we do look carefully at bottled water quality, we find problems. And in my book, I chronicle a whole series of examples of bottled water contaminations that the public was never notified about. I had to file a Freedom of Information Act request with the Food and Drug Administration to get this information, and it found examples of bacteria and glass particles and sanitizer and mold and all sorts of things occasionally found in bottled water that the public was either not notified about or was notified long after the bottles were sold.
Let's talk about, you mentioned in your book that the problem here is not just economic problems being caused, but there's environmental, but there's other bigger problems too. Let's talk a little bit about the social cost of bottled water.
Well, part of the social cost is this, to me, concern that we're just going to stop supporting our tap water system. That's a system that provides everyone with safe and affordable clean water. If we abandon our tap water system, if we let it go to hell in a handbasket, then the rich will buy bottled water and the poor will drink contaminated water, and so that's a social problem. But there are a whole set of other issues associated with the energy required to make and move bottled water, which is enormous, the environmental implications of disposing of these plastic bottles, and 70% of them never get recycled. They end up in our landfills, they end up by the side of the road, they end up in trash. They could be recycled, but they're not. Those are problems associated with bottled water, too, that I think as a society we don't adequately understand or deal with.
Well, this is one thing. This is one aspect of your book that I really feel obliged to hit on, and that's the hucksterism, because it just, you know, I go through life just enraged all the time, every time I see this. And in fact, although I took notes down saying, now, you're sure that drinking bottled water will not make me slimmer. Is that you're going to stand behind that?
Oh, well, let me qualify that. There are a bunch of bottled waters that are advertised as weight loss waters, and I think the FDA really ought to get on that, because that's completely crap. But if you do drink several glasses of water before you eat, you may well eat less, and that may be an interesting weight loss program, but it has nothing to do with the special properties of bottled water. You could get that same benefit from drinking any water. So I think that's a bogus claim.
So what about hexagonal water?
Well, there are all sorts of other bizarre claims about bottled water, about having specially reorganized and rearranged the molecules, about there's some pretty clearly medicine show snake oil type of waters out there that I think the Food and Drug Administration or the Federal Trade Commission, whoever's responsible for protecting us from misleading advertising, ought to be dealing with. I think they've fallen down on the job on this, and the public is often being misled about these special bottled waters.
For a long time, I believed that there were a bunch of elves in the North Pole who were rearranging water molecules, and then I found out that was Santa Claus and Christmas, and that's true, but the elves in the North Pole making water was not true. Okay?
Yeah, that's
it. Back on the social cost of water, because I do think this is really important. You know, you had made a point earlier about it was with the development of the tap system, and to the extent that it's developed, and a very highly developed one, that we were able to wipe out things like cholera. And in conjunction with other programs, we were able to wipe out things like cholera and dysentery and all this. But then social impact of the neglect of the tap, and that image you painted of that possible world. I mean, you talk about it in your book, you talk about a couple of possible futures. And frankly, one that you paint, which is coming off of what you were just talking about, the social cost of bottled water, you've conjured up a world that is bone-chillingly similar to what we all shivered at when we first saw it in the film Blade Runner. You know, and it reminds me even a lot, there's a lot of similarities between this and the fossil fuel industry, you know, and the whole way that they're rampaging through society. Can you talk to that a little bit and then maybe talk about what your vision of the future is?
Well, I think bottled water, as I said earlier, is a symptom of a much bigger set of problems with water. Water is our most precious resource. We don't treat it and use it sustainably in the United States or in California or in the globe, throughout the world as a whole. I think we can move to a sustainable future for water. I think we could provide safe and clean water and sanitation for everyone. We haven't done it, but we could do it. It's not a technological problem. It's not a money problem. It's a problem of commitment and will. I think we could move to a world in which our natural ecosystems share in the water that we use. Many of our environmental problems, certainly in California and the western U.S., but elsewhere as well, are associated with the fact that for years, for decades, we've taken more and more water out of the environment for human use. You know, we move water from the Sierra Nevada to the coast and Northern California to Southern California, or, you know, the Colorado River is completely consumed, and that's brought enormous advantages to us, but it's also caused a lot of big environmental problems. It's time to treat the environment as a user as well. They deserve a sustainable share of our water resources. I think we can move to that future. I think we can move to a future where we understand how climate change is going to affect us and we manage the unavoidable consequences of climate change. I think there's good news out there in the water world, but as long as we continue to think that bottled water is an acceptable alternative to a safe tap water system, as long as we continue to assume that humans can take all the water they want without protecting the environment, I think the possibility of a bad future is certainly out there.
I want to sort of begin to wrap this thing up here, but I want to make the point that the vision that you laid out just now, the fact, the idea, the thinking that there's nothing actually holding this back, really, except, and I think it's the social relations and the production relations that exist in society. There's no technological reason. There's certainly not a question of need. There's not like we couldn't do this if we didn't really grasp it or something. There's something blocking this. And you make a point at a number of points in your book. You make the basic point that this is bigger than environmental, bigger than economic, that it's a basic question of human rights and the right of all humans to have access to good, clean water. And it's also a question of the survival of the planet. And so in that question, the bigger question of the whole future of humanity. And your vision, when I read that in your book, I was really inspired by that. But I was also forced to say, you know, I don't think under this system. Do you really think that there's some way that you can achieve this, given where we exist now in this society?
You know, I do. Maybe it makes me a rosy-eyed optimist. I do believe that we can have a sustainable water system around the world. I do believe that it's achievable. I believe it's inevitable. It's not a technological problem. It's not an economic problem. It's a question of political will. It's a question of activism on the part of people understanding where their water comes from and pushing agencies and communities and governments to do the right thing. I'm not naive. I do believe it's going to be difficult. The question is how much pain and suffering are we going to have to go through before we move to a sustainable system of water management and water planning and water use. But I absolutely believe it's achievable. I think we just have to understand more about our water. We have to take responsibility for our own decisions about water, and we have to move policymakers and politicians in the right direction, not the wrong direction.
Well, I would say I really like your vision, and I would agree with you that we can do this, but I think there's a big impediment, and that is the fact that in order to do this, we have to get rid of a society that functions first and foremost on profit before everything, because that actually ends up with a whole big mess, ends up where we are now. And that's something you and I can continue to wrestle with, but I really want to follow your work on this, and I want to thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure, Peter. Take care, and we'll talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Peter Gleick, author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. Check it out. It's a really great book.
And once again, that brings us to the close of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, David Zeiger, filmmaker, and Saskia Sassen, the Robert S. Lind Professor of Sociology and the co-chair of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University. And all three are members of the host committee for a dialogue that's coming up between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation, and the Role of Religion. And that's going to be happening in New York City at Riverside Church on November 15th. And believe me, if there's any way you can get there, you should be there. You don't want to miss this. And I also want to thank my guest, Peter Gleick. Peter is the author of the book, Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. And I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And just one more thing. I'd like to read people a quote from the book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And I'm reading this quote because of the whole atmosphere that's been churned up around the recent elections, what's happening there, and the idea that that is somehow, the electoral path is somehow the way to get change, and that what we need is we need real democracy. Well, I wanted to read this for people to think about. In a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequality, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule, and it will uphold and promote that kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is, which class will rule, and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation or the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation, oppression, and inequality. And once again, that's from Bob Avakian, and you can find that in his book, Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And you can get that at revcom.us. And you can also find out all kinds of information about the upcoming dialogue at revcom.us. And we're going to go out now with a song that I thought was appropriate for the time of the year and the way I'm feeling. This is Screamin' Jay Hawkins with I Put a Spell on You.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up?